We're going to begin the segment with the great and legendary John Drummond, former CBS newsman, television reporter. John, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
How are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Not too bad. Glad you invited me on.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of yours. I grew up here in Chicago. I saw you.
Well, I don't. Fans, we can meet. We meet in a telephone booth all the time. That's about all we got left, I think.
So, about maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. Well, you were at. Before I want to set you up. I mean, you were at CBS from '69 to about '97. WBBM.
That's correct. And then I worked. I've been worked freelance quite a bit for them until about through the Family Secrets trial. So I haven't done much since about 2010, 2012, but I contributed quite a bit. I had an arrangement there that I was working sort of as a freelancer for a long time there.
Yeah, I want to get to some specific questions about it. It's now been 20 years since you retired, but so anyway, I'm in a store, like a card shop, a sports store in Naperville, Triple Crown Trading Company,
oh, sure.
Run by our friend Tom Morgan, and
yes.
I pick up your book. I didn't know it was even out. It's called It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real. It's your second book.
That's correct.
I brought it in the studio. It's by Chicago Spectrum Press in Louisville, Kentucky. So let's start with that. I read a little bit of it. It's a collection of like some of your memories and stuff. So when did you do these books?
Well, I had the first one called 30 Years in the Trenches. That's one of the reasons I did when I started to retire, give them more time to. I wanted to do a book, at least one book. Mostly those stories are vignettes of stories that I covered about Chicago characters and people. The first one I did, the 30 Years in the Trenches, covering the crooks, characters, and capers, had a lot of features, a lot of character type people. Literally the word characters, a lot of guys in that, but there was some organized crime stuff as well. And other stories we did, and I said, I got to have a rematch. It spawned a little cottage industry because I had a lot of speaking engagements. As a result of that, we sold a lot of those books for a regional book. And then I put the second one together, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real.
And is it true, was that a motto or a thing at Channel 2 for a
Yes,
while?
It was,
in
as a matter of fact. The second, you got it right on the head. That is, on our newscast there, they weren't pretty, but they were real. That's the point. When they had Curtis and Jacobs in our so-called heyday, when our newsroom was, when the newscast started to come from the newsroom rather than a studio, and they coined that phrase, the people in the publicity department, and it was quite effective.
Be kind of the name for this show, It Ain't Pretty,
yeah,
But
there
It's
you
real.
Go, there yeah. you go.
I was talking to you this week, just setting some of this up, and I want the listeners to know that before you went into television, you were on radio. You were at WIND.
I certainly was. When IND was, I call it, may I use that phrase, the in its heyday. When it was owned by Westinghouse, our studios were in the Wrigley Building, and we got great numbers. I remember in the morning, I think I mentioned this to you, that Howard Miller was our morning. Drive time is very important, as you know, in radio. And Wally Phillips was legendary. He used the term legendary before, and he was a legendary morning man for him for years. But when he went head-to-head at that time with Howard Miller, IND got the better numbers.
And what did you do at IND?
Well, I did news, basically reported and did newscasts. I mean, we did both. We had a good news operation.
And what was the news scene like? You were there from probably 67 to 69 before you went to
That's
Chicago.
Correct. That's yeah. correct.
And what was it like? What was it like doing news in Chicago on radio
well,
in 1960?
It was a change. I mean, I'd been working in a WHO in Des Moines before I came in here, which had, by the way, a bigger news department, I think, than any Chicago station at that time, believe it or not. But that's another story. But it came in at a time that the turbulence was starting with, of course, the disturbances during the Dr. King riots in the spring of 68. Then, we had the convention miscues and rioting in August of 68. So that's a year you'll never forget, with those disturbances.
And you say in the book I picked up, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real, that Dr. King, you know, you've covered so much stuff, but the Dr. King riots was a big memory for you. That was an important
thing. Well, you couldn't
stand.
I thought that was so indifferent. So I tell you, I remember looking out the building, the room, the window at the Wrigley Building. You could see on the west side, smoke just billowing up heading towards Cicero, and it looked like something out of a World War II picture. I mean, my gosh, you figured the whole, I thought at that time, plus the disturbances we had in 68 and later the riots that we had in 69, the days of rage and so on and so forth, I'm beginning to think the whole fabric was falling apart. I thought we could possibly be on the verge of a revolution. Seriously, I did believe that. I thought there were going to be real trouble.
And
the Vietnam War, of course, remember, was going on at that time, and there was considerable problems with that, with particularly young people objecting to be going to be drafted and so on and so forth.
I was telling you, and for our studio audience here, we're all from the western suburbs, and I was the editor of my high school paper out in Naperville Central, and they let me interview some of my interesting radio people, and I remember coming down to interview Howard Miller. So tell the listeners what Howard Miller was like, and what you were telling me the other day about his reaction to the King.
Well, what Miller was actually, he was primarily what we used to call a disc jockey. He was not really a talk show host. He made his bones and being probably along with this guy, was it Howard Block or Block from WABC in New York, probably the two most influential disc jockeys in the country. They could make or break a record. And Miller was even married to a famous singer by the name of June Valley. But, of course, that got old, and he being the switch to a talk radio morning, that's what he didn't play any records hardly at all anymore in that morning shift. And he became conservative politically. I think his father was a judge, if I recall, believe it or not. And Miller had a long, very, very, very loyal following. And what happened was that during the disturbances in the April of 68, he got on the air Monday morning. Remember, the disturbances started Friday after the shooting down in Memphis. And there was a lot of rumors going around what was going to happen, how long the disturbances were going to continue. But actually, they're dying out at that point. But what he said was he mentioned on the air, he said, "We've heard that they are going to be marching right up down Michigan Avenue." They meaning these young people, primarily African-Americans walking out. He said, "If they do, let's go out and meet them." In other words, he was urging people to be there and do battle royal with them. He was taken off the air almost immediately by Westinghouse. And that ended Miller's career.
That was the end of his career, right.
And also, he went over to WCFL for a while. That was
I do remember that.
And that he didn't get the numbers even over there. That something happened, they never did. But the fandom was very loyal. I recall, right after he had been liquidated, so to speak, doing a story in Cicero, and covering George Wallace. And a lot of adherents of Wallace lived in Cicero at that time, and I was out in their news car, but they had their own mobile unit. And I was surrounded by angry constituents, so to speak, and they were threatening to rock the car and everything, and I was trying to point out, look, I had nothing to do with Miller being canned. That came from Washington, from Pittsburgh. And so that ended that. But Miller, it fanned out, but there a while that Miller had a great deal of support, and unfortunately for the station, after he left, our numbers never, they tailspinned.
Yeah.
And that paved the way for Phillips to take command, as he did all the time till he retired.
Okay, Mr. Drummond, we're going to take a break here from spots, and then I want to come back and I want to ask you how you thought television news has changed in the last 20 years since you retired. So think about that, and we'll be back with the great John Drummond on Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal with our guest, a member of the Chicago Journalism Hall of Fame, among other things, a current crime reporter, John Drummond. Thanks for joining us, John.
My pleasure, Dave. As I indicated before, we're having a ball.
Yeah, this is great. We got to hang out.
All right, we'll do that.
How about we hang out at La Scarola, you and me?
Okay.
All right. I cued you before the spots. Do you watch the news now, and how do you think the news
is? Yeah, I watch the early news. I don't watch the 10 o'clock cast. That's beyond my bedtime normally, I must confess. But I do watch television. I was curious to see what's going on and that type of thing locally. Well, right now with Mr. Trump in command, I'm fascinated so much by the national scene that's priority right now. I wonder what the Donald's going to do every day. There's never been so much excitement in that sense.
How about the local news and the way they cover crime? How has it changed?
Well, I think it's changed a lot. When I went to work back then, you've got to bear in mind when I started, it was the film day. We did not have videotape at that time at all. I know that sounds primitive, but that was true. We had four daily newspapers in Chicago at that point. And frankly, we did get meaning all of the stations got some of a lot of our news from the papers. As you can imagine, there are different editions coming out all the time.
Sure.
Like the Tribune would have that Bulldog edition early, then 7:30 another edition, 9:30 that night. The Daily News would come out around 10:30 in the morning. They had more so. That was a resource when you had limited senses. But we were doing more of this at those days. We're not covering the crime like they do today, not these murders. We'd cover things like the, I know this may sound boring, the water reclamation district, the sanitary district then. We'd go to the school board almost regularly. They still do that to a degree. We'd go to the park district and so on and so forth, as well as the city council, of course, and the county board. And so some of that was the stuff we were doing initially, quite a bit of that stuff. Although we always had a lot of disturbances because of that period, too. We had a lot of disturbances at the high schools because of that point in the inner city. because most of the principals and superior and people and officials in those schools were white, and that of course caused a lot of disturbances at Gage Park and Crane. I can go through the list. So that was keeping us busy, needless to say, and always rioting, so to speak. But we did not cover the homicides. In fact, if I may digress one bit, when I was hired at WIND, we had a writer's test there, and the news director gave me copy to rewrite and put on for a five-minute newscast. And I led at that point with a homicide, with the inner-city homicide, which I thought was a pretty big story. And he chided me on it. He said, well, we don't lead with those stories now because they happen, frankly, a little too much. We report them, but we don't go hog wild on them in that matter. And that's the difference today. The biggest difference today, first of all, your revenues are down. The television audience, news audience today is infinitesimal compared to what was in the high day, let's say in the late 70s, early 80s. Everybody, I use the word everybody, but the 10 o'clock news was mandatory watching almost at that time.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's when BBM was in its heyday, and all the stations were. And we got that audience at that time, and that's not the case now. So we had resources more to spend to go over to go on trips. Curtis was going all the time. And I remember he went to Africa several times. They called him Buona Bill, practically. He was going over there so much. But anyway, we spent money on that. I went at the top of a dime. We'd jump out to a story. It was a kidnapping in Palm Springs. I went to cover that, things of that nature. I'm pointing out. They can't do that right now. The revenue is way down, the numbers are down, and the costs of operating are more expensive. So the result, television news is more bare-boned. And it's easy right now. You're a producer like Dave pulling out for the 10 o'clock news tonight. What am I going to lead with? I got to come up with something hard. Well, it's very easy to cover a homicide in the inner city or anywhere, homicide anywhere for that matter, but there's more, let's face it, unfortunately, in the inner city. To go down there, a live shot, it's dramatic, and it's a good way to start the news. And that's why they use that term, if it bleeds, it leads.
Right.
There's more to it than that. It's not baloney completely. And homicides, by the way, the point is that I remember the heyday, I remember in 1974, because I remember these stories, we had 970 homicides in Chicago. There's nowhere near that today. And I'm saying one homicide is obviously too many. I'm not trying to belittle that point, and it's too many, but it's happened before. This is not, some people think it's the sky is falling, it's Armageddon. It's not. Unfortunately, it is not.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to reduce it, but I'm saying this has happened before.
I think there's too much weather on the 10 o'clock news.
Well, listen, some people turn in for the weather. You know, I'll give you a quick story. I worked at Rockford before one time, W Channel 13, and they get the numbers on them. They led with the weather.
Yeah.
But here's what happened. Then after the weather, people were dialing it out, so they had to put it back. So,
You know, I was talking to you this week, but I was telling you some of the questions I was asked, but how'd you get the name Bulldog? Who gave you the name Bulldog?
Actually, until I came really to BBM, I did not have that name, and people think maybe you had it because there was a fictional detective, English detective, by the name of Bulldog Drummond. In fact, they made some movies with him, but that was not the reason. Nobody ever called me that until I came over to Channel 2, and the only thing I can assume that I've been told that supposedly, allegedly, I had so much tenacity in doing stories that I became a bulldog by doing it. So that's how the nickname stood. That's how it started.
In your career, what was the most disturbing scene or disturbing thing you ever saw? I'm sure you saw a lot of grisly things. What sticks out as a really, really horrible thing you witnessed?
Well, of course, plane crashes and things like that, uh-huh, or anything like that, disasters. Although, as I indicate, I think that still the idea, as I pointed out before, the disturbances in 68, and then, of course, the Days of Rage in 69, which a lot of people, I think that was more disturbing to me than anything else, because it looked like the thing that we used to was disappearing, that we had real problems. I think that was the thing. Of course, obviously, we're always interested in organized crime, homicides, and those were always startling, and things of that were always that way interesting to cover in that sense. And the disappearance of people like Helen Brock and some, right, of these women that vanished, those are always fascinating stories, too, that have never been solved, and at least on paper. I mean, in reality, although you can theorize who did it, those type of things in any of those cases. Those are always fascinating. That's great for anniversary stories, by the way, when a newsroom is death needs a story someday.
Yeah, you're right.
Hey, what happened 40 years ago or 50 years ago? Hey, we'll lead with it. Put it on tonight, you know.
Man, I there's so many questions I've got for you. You're going to have to come back. We got to stop at 9:30.
Well, I'll have for a rematch. I'm looking forward
to it.
But
I got a couple more things I want to squeeze in here. In your book, which is, people can find this, right? It Ain't Pretty, But It's
Amazon,
Real.
Amazon, that's correct. And the other one's 30 Years in the Trenches. Although, by God, I think we're almost done with maybe out of print on the first one, which I even like better, frankly.
This is great stuff. But you say to my parents, Frank and Maude Drummond, who did so much for me, I know we talked today, I know you're from Eau Claire.
That's
just
correct.
Tell us a little bit what your parents did.
Well, my father was worked in a slaughterhouse, a packing plant. They had actually he was the superintendent of that plant, and he was one of the reasons I didn't get into that business. He had a tough job. He was in charge of the stockyards, the kill floor, and then inside when they were processing the food. He had a very tough job. He'd come home at night after working there and change his clothes because they smelled of death, and he'd put on a suit and go downtown once in a while, hang out at the hotel or something like that, just to get out of that for a change. And he said, "Don't ever do this business."
Wow.
It was part of the family deal. He had his, actually, it was the name of the Drummond Packing Company, but don't get the idea that was a solo dealer. So, you know, several of his uncles, several people had. It was a big operation. The plant was small, of course, by armor style, but I remember it. Had they not sold out the plant, I probably would have ended up working there. I don't doubt it.
Did he? Do you have his voice? Did he talk like you?
Well, no. Nobody liked it. I tell you, we lived in Eau Claire. He loved Chicago. He loved reading about Chicago. He got the Daily Tribune up there, and it's always fascinating me. He got the Tribune there every day.
Okay.
So he was always up in arms about what was going on in the city.
Okay. Well, John Drummond, thanks. Will you come back?
I'll come back. I work cheap, so there's no problem.
I want to ask you about The Fugitive, and I want to get more into the book. So let's have you back sometime, okay?
Give me a call anytime.
Okay. Thank you, John Drummond, author of the book, It Ain't Pretty, But It's Real.
All right, Dave. I thank you now.